Todd Rundgren. Hello, it's me, Rosie, your host, here to tell you some fun, crazy things I discovered this week. Because honestly, up until like Wednesday afternoon, I want to say, or Thursday morning, I was not planning on doing this. My topic was going to be Bruce Springsteen's Secret Garden and a couple of other songs that relate to each other. And then I got distracted. Really distracted and went down a giant rabbit hole that has taken over my life for about the last 4 days. But well worthwhile. This had its origin in me listening to the song The First Cut is the Deepest, because I felt it kind of related to Secret Garden in a way. But I'll elaborate on that when I do the Secret Garden show. Anyways, so I was listening to it, and I decided to look up its history. I had no idea it had been written by Cat Stevens, also known as Yousef. So I was like, well, that's cool. I love the Cat Stevens songs that I know, and I like this one too. Like, I was pretty sure Rod Stewart hadn't written it. And therefore I knew Sheryl Crow hadn't written it, because she did her version like 30 years after Rod's. But this all will tie in together in a minute, because Rod the Mod will show back up again later in this story. Anyways, so I was listening to the various versions of The First Cut is the Deepest that are out there. The Cat Stevens one, which features guitar done by none other than Big Jim Sullivan, whose existence caused Jimmy Page to be called Little Jimmy P, when he was a session musician, to distinguish between the two. So the fledgling Yardbird with Little Jimmy P, until he spread his wings and flew the coop to fame and fortune on the Led Zeppelin. Which Led Zeppelin will also come up later, too. And this is all relating to one thing, which is the artist known as P.P. Arnold, her real name is Patricia Ann Cole, who did the first recording of The First Cut is the Deepest. Hers preceded Cat's recording of his own song by about 6 months. And looking into this lady's history is mind-blowing. I have 3 pages of notes, and that's after trying to pare it down. So, buckle up, y'all, and get ready for one roller coaster of a career and a story. Patricia, born in Los Angeles to a family who had recently immigrated there from Tyler, Texas. Yeehaw! She sang in her choir at her, family's Baptist church. In fact, her family was gospel singers even. But then she got pregnant and got married, as one does, especially in the 60s. And then ended up trapped with 2 kids, working 2 jobs, in an abusive marriage. So, her backstory is about as Cinderella as you can get. No money, no connections, no name. She's not even trying to pursue music. She's busy being a provider with 2 jobs. And, trying to not get hit. Anyways, her 2 friends call her up and they're like, Pat, we need somebody to sing with us because our friend that was going to audition with us dropped out. And she's like, I can't. Like, my husband would not allow that. But she ends up talking her husband into watching the kids. And is like, I'm going to go shopping, but not. Where they then go and audition as a trio and are hired on the spot to be the new Iquettes by Ike and Tina Turner. Try that for an ironic twist of fate. You're rescued out of an abusive marriage by Ike and Tina. Plot twist! Anyways, so she's got this career now. Her kids are staying with her parents. And she's touring the Chitlin' Circuit through the South with the Ike and Tina Turner Review. And they even end up opening for the Rolling Stones. At which point, the faith that sunk 1,000 ships, or wiggled 100,000 hips, Mr. Mick Jagger becomes friends with her. And it's like, I think you should pursue a solo career. You're kind of better than just being a backing singer. You got some real quality. And just so happens, the Rolling Stones manager, whose name is like Andrew Lug Oldman, he's got a very peculiar name. Like, Luke, what kind of name is that? I'm hoping I even said it correctly. I have no real idea on that one. Anyways, Andrew Lou Goldman is forming a new record label called Immediate Records. Hence how P.P. Arnold becomes the first lady of Immediate. Other label mates include bands you've never heard of, like Fleetwood Mac and the Small Faces. Not only will she end up doing backing vocals on some of Small Faces' biggest hits, or aka the only songs you ever hear played on the radio by the Small Faces in spite of their influential, you know, career, she lends her backing vocals on Ichiku Park and Tin Soldier. She also sings later down the road on Rod Stewart's, I want to say it's The Long Road Home or Long Way Home. It's not a song I was familiar with, but so there's Rod the Mod popping up. I'm not sure what he was doing during Small Faces because he didn't join the band till Faces, so maybe he's being Jeff Beck Group and trying to be solo. I'd have to look into that, and honestly, I've been on enough rabbit holes on this lady's career that I don't know that I have the mental energy to look up what Rod Stewart was doing with his career at the time. Keeping up with this lady's alone is a task. So she's singing Small Faces, Ronnie Lane, and Steve Marriott lend their voice to her backing vocals on to do backing vocals on some of her songs on her first album. They also do some writing and producing on those songs, like So You Think You're Groovy is one of those songs, which is good. That's her first album, is also where The First Cut Is the Deepest makes its appearance. And a really beautiful song, which I always forget the title of, so I wrote it down. Though It Hurts Me Badly, which is a story of not unrequited romance, but rather having to hide your romance, which was written by Pat about the disapproval of interracial couples at the time, because she was dating Steve Marriott and had to keep it on the down low, because even in unsegregated, hip and swinging 60s London, it still wasn't okay with either color involved to be dating somebody of the other color. It also proved that Steve Marriott not only could sing like a black lady, but apparently he could swing with a black lady. If you ever listen to Humble Pie's Black Coffee, the fact that that's a, you know, 20-year-old white British man is really irreconcilable with the voice that you're hearing on that album. You're like, that dude's got to be black! Not only that, I think he's a woman! Talk about blue-eyed soul. Nobody talks about Steve Marriott enough. The man could literally sound like a black woman, and that's not an easy thing to do. So anyways, her, sad but tragic star-crossed romance with Steve Marriott aside, her career keeps flying on. She does a second album called Kafunta. Kafunta. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it correctly. I couldn't even find it out anything about it. And there's a Kafunta Nature Reserve in Zambia. And in between it sounding African and her wearing a very tribal looking headdress on, I'm pretty sure it's African. Definitely seemed to be going with the African motif and theme for that second album, which is really kind of groovy for the 60s, you know. Not sure that everybody was approving of it back at that time, when, you know, at least in America, you know, we were still fighting the civil rights movement, and in Britain, things weren't exactly perfect either, because she couldn't openly date Steve Marriott. So anyways, she's, got the second album, which is really good. I've listened to at least four of her albums. I think there is only four. There may be a fifth that I couldn't find as easily. And so she's, got the help of two friendly wizards on this album. They're, keyboard wizards, that is. One of which being about to launch off in the great and mighty Led Zeppelin, John Paul Jones, who did the orchestral arranging on this album, the same year that he would board the Zeppelin, 1968. What a year for music. Anyways, so Kafunta has John Paul Jones doing orchestral arrangements. It also has keyboard wizard Keith Emerson and his band The Nice backing her. You know, another no-name you've never heard of. You know, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer never did anything. They're no-names. That's a law firm, right? anyways. So, Keith Emerson's over there, and then while she's working on what should have been her third album, getting production assistant from assistants, you know, or not even assistants, he's doing all the producing, from another no-name you've never heard of called Barry Gibb. You know, him and his brothers aren't famous for anything. He's actually, at this point, taking a break from being with his brothers due to the fact that, you know, sometimes you get tired of working with your family. So the Bee Gees are on hiatus. Barry's over here. This actually breeds some turmoil because I want to say it's the manager, record executive, one of the record people, not the musicians, is kind of trying to pressure Barry to get back with his brothers, and so he doesn't want him doing these side projects and solo projects and producing and anything like and songwriting. They're like, no, get back and make money with your brothers. So that's one of the reasons why this third album will not be seen for several decades. Also on this third album, she gets assistance of a divine nature. She had the divine assistance when God answered her prayers for help out of her marriage, literally like the day before. Her friends were like, you're coming with us to audition for Argentina. And now she has divine interference from the guitar god, Eric Clapton, who helps her produce some more songs for this album. You know, no names. These people never did anything with you. You've never heard of Eric Clapton. No one's ever heard of Eric Clapton, right? So she actually ends up opening for Eric on his Delaney and Bonnie and Friends tour. You know, there was nobody important on that tour. George Harrison, nobody ever heard of. No one even talks about the Delaney and Bonnie tour. Except for that's all they talk about. That's, you know, one of his most famous tours. So, she's opening for him. Incidentally, her backing band now has the future Yes Man, Steve Howe, in it. So, you know, another castaway. Yes never did anything. Yes is nobody. Nobody's heard of Yes. And then she's still struggling to get this album out. And the tape, she just can't get a hold of them. In her words, it was politics that was keeping this album from getting out, and also she just couldn't hustle. That was her quote. You know, she didn't know who to talk to and how to really get there. In fact, by her own admission, she's pretty sure her shyness that she had helped, in a way, to protect her from the just maelstrom of craziness that was 60s and 70s London. On the rock and roll scene, so she didn't really get into the, you know, drug, sex, and rock and roll lifestyle, though she was living in an area, in an environment where she totally could have gone down that path. So, props to being shy, she, made it out alive. Well done. She also, at this time, so she can't get the album out, and she suffers a personal loss in the late 70s of, losing her oldest daughter in a car accident. And she doesn't, you know, show up in the public eye for about a year. And had this woman's career ended here, you know, had she just retired after losing her daughter, which some artists have done that, you know, some people do that, they just sort of don't continue doing what they were doing before, she would still have a resume that would be nigh impossible to beat. But she's not done. Come the 80s, she is on roller skates in the debut of Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical The Starlight Express. And she's also lending her voice to the blockbuster that is Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer. I don't really enjoy that song. I don't understand why it was as popular as it is, but I don't question it. It's the 80s, and there's a whole lot more questionable things than Sledgehammer going on in the 80s. She's performing with everybody from Boy George to Billy Ocean, and just everything. Like, the 80s, she's as all over the place as the fashion is, but in a much better and classier way. I'm looking at my notes, I'm sorry. Like I said, it's really hard to keep track of this lady's career. She collaborates with Steve Marriott one last time, not long before the tragic house fire that took Steve from us way too soon. So at least they got to do one more musical project together. She is doing everything from reggae to electropop. She's singing her heart out all over the place. Like I said, the 80s especially, she's really hard to keep up with. In the 90s, she's going to tour at the end of the decade with Roger Waters of Pink Floyd on one of his tours. And not too far into the 2000s, she'll do so again. Also in the 2000s, a play will be made out of the career of Small Faces, which will present her and Steve Marriott's relationship on stage and open to the public, and ironically contrasted to how it was at the time, where it had to be off stage and in secret and no one could know about it. She also, I'm trying to think, like, there's so much stuff this lady did. She's truly a force of nature, and I don't understand why she's not discussed more. Like, she has this quote to prove how she sort of overcame as much as she overcame. She's like, faith has brought me a long way, and I'm hard-headed too. And I'm like, I feel like you gotta be kind of stubborn to keep going after as much stuff as she went through, and then to, you know, persevere and just succeed. I mean, granted, she didn't get the public accolades that she pretty rightly deserves, but she's not been in want for work her whole career. I mean, in the 80s, I think in the latter part of the 80s, she also returned to, like, doing regular session work. And so it's just really astounding how much stuff this woman's done. Like, it boggles the mind. Now, in either the 80s or the 90s, she encountered this band that was called Ocean Color Scene. I have never heard of them before, and I haven't looked into listening to them. They may be good. I don't know. I'll have to check them out. But their guitarist, Steve Craddock, and his wife Sally took it upon themselves to hustle where Pat could not, and to snout out those tapes for her third album that never was. Oh, so they're little truffle hunting pigs. I'm sorry, Instagram showed me the trailer for Pig, and I swear that movie better be a spoof, because Nicolas Cage is trolling us. Side note, sorry, I'm still, like, in a brain fog. I'm like, that can't actually be a real film. We're not that desperate, are we? Truffle hunting pigs as an R-rated drama. Anyways, far more important than truffles, and far more logical than the plot for that film, from what I could tell from the trailer, you have Mr. and Mrs. Craddock hunting down these tapes, which they did, and they finally get them, and some other Heat people, I think, help too, and she gets it out and released in 2017. You know, about definitely over 45 years after it was supposed to be released. Thank you, record company people being difficult. And then 2 years later, in 2019, Pat releases an album called The New Adventures of P.P. Arnold, which, there's not just 2 years between those albums coming out, You would think so in her voice. You would think that these were songs that she had recorded in, you know, 1972, after 1969 or so, when the first album, I mean, when that third album should have came out. But they're not. They're recorded in the present tense, as in at that time, for that album. But her voice has aged that immaculately that I had to look it up. Like, I was like, are these just more old recordings that they found and they released, you know, maybe on some new arrangements and backing tracks or something? No, they're from the modern era. This lady can still sing breathtakingly. She does a really fun, good cover on that album of different drum. There's also, I haven't listened to it yet, but there's a sort of spoken word rapped poetry cover of Bob Dylan's poem. I think it's like the last words of Woody Guthrie. It's something to do with Woody Guthrie. I had not heard of it before. As the final track on that album. It's a bunch of stuff. What I listened to, which was about the first half of the album, is really good. Along with all of her other three albums from her earlier career, even though the one wasn't released till 2017, they're all really good. Really enjoyed her first album, I've had it on repeat, and her album that was released in 2017 that should have been released in, like, 1971, which is called, I keep wanting to call it The Long Walk Home for some reason, The Turning Tide. The Turning Tide is the name of the album. She has this really beautiful song called The Children of the Last War, and it's not one of the ones that Clapton or Gibb did with her. It's the other guy with it. Want to say his name was Steve Quay or something Quay. He had an unusual last name like that. And it's really bittersweet and beautiful, and it gave me chills. And her voice is perfect. Her voice, I enjoy her voice because it's not your typical 60s poppy, Mary Wells kind of sounding voice. And it's not, you know, Motown with, you know, the Supremes and all that. No, I'm not, I enjoy the Supremes. But it's got more, it's not whitewashed. It's got soul to it. It's got a, like, it's still a very beautiful, clear voice, but it's got rough edges to it, so I would distance it from any comparisons to Motown black female singers and put it closer to, like, Darlene Love and Ronnie Spector. But even more so than that, it's like if Carole King was a black lady, that's sort of the best thing I can come up with, and had an even better voice. So Carole King with a way better voice and black, and that's sort of the closest comparison, because it's got sort of that, I wish I knew musical terms better. Just listen to it, you'll understand. As her songs go that I've heard, the ones I would recommend the most would be So You Think You're Groovy, because it's a fun song. And The Children of the Last War and Different Drum are the three that I can remember off the top of my head that I really, really liked, but there's not a song that I was like, skip. And I have Spotify Premium, so I can skip if I want to. Really enjoyed everything that I listened to. It was either like high quality arrangement and I was just like, this is very pleasant and I have no objection to it. Or it was just hitting me in the feels, and I was like, this is some good stuff. So, that is today's ramble on Miss Patricia Ann Cole, aka P.P. Arnold, who I cannot understand why she's not talked about more. It's pretty crazy, because she's done so much with so many big-name people, you'd think somebody would have talked about her before now. Like, I feel like he probably has an underground garage, but I haven't listened to all of his episodes. I'm gonna die of shock if I get all the way to the current 1050th episode that's out there now, and he didn't discuss her at some point. That will be when I know that I've gone really deep into the underground world of 60s music, when I find someone that Steven Van Zandt has not discussed on Underground Garage. That would be great, though. That would be all the lifetime achievement I need. But regardless, that aside, I hope y'all enjoyed this. I think she's just got one of the most inspiring stories, even if she wasn't, super successful getting out of a dismal, horrid, abusive situation. And like I said, even if her career had ended when her child had, tragically passed, she'd still had a resume hard to top. Hard to even match. And she's... I read some interviews with her, and she's very perky and lively. Like, when asked about her career, which you'd think... she has some decent reasons to be bitter. She's just sort of like, I've been blessed my whole life. I've been taken care of, it's well, and, which is a pretty amazing viewpoint to have, when she could definitely justifiably have bitter sentiments towards people who have done her wrong or neglected her in ways. So she's an extraordinary human being, in addition to an extraordinary voice and an extraordinary career. And so I hope my discussion of the amazing life of P.P. Arnold, something should be like a children's adventure book, has brought you insight, and go check out her music. It's great. There's not a whole lot to check out, unfortunately. I mean, unless you go listening to all the songs that she sang for, like, backing vocals or lead vocals on other people's records, then you might find a little more than you can handle. But of her own solo productions, there's not a whole lot. You can catch up on it in a day or two of, listening on your drive home. If you've got YouTube or Spotify and stuff, you should be able to find them there. That's where I listened to her stuff. And so I will leave you with a quote of how she summed up her own life, which is, "The unexpected always rules my life. Destiny takes over. I just put it in God's hands, and the unexpected brings some kind of situation that's good for me." And that really seems to be the best summation of a unsummarizable life. Because I tried to just keep it down and succinct and only, the big names. And for context, this is my notes. The woman's life cannot be summed up in a page. But apparently she can sum it up herself in a quote. So, on that note, and one final inspiring quote by this amazing, inspiring woman, which is to keep on believing, hold on to your dreams, and it's never too late. Which is pretty... If that came from somebody who came from privilege, it would mean nothing. But coming from a lady whose history is as varied and has had as many low points as hers, it's a pretty meaningful statement coming from that source. So take that with you on your day. I've taken it with me on mine because I feel like it's appropriate. Like, I'm learning how to play guitar, and I feel like I'm doing that way too late in my life. I mean, I'm in my mid-20s, and I've never played a musical instrument before, and here I am picking up a new one. But quotes and people, like Miss Arnold, or rather, Miss Cole, are an inspiration to keep on trucking and keep on strumming, and y'all keep on rocking. In the meantime, y'all have a wonderful week, and I hope you enjoyed this, and that's all, folks!